Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Chains of Darkness by Frederick Nebel. Part 1, Death for Two. The loose, flat jangle of the telephone bell sounded in the darkened room. Eastward, over the rooftops, a post-midnight elevated train slammed south. The bell stopped ringing. Wind from the East River bellied white curtains inward, rattled the wooden rod of a half-drawn shade. The bell rang again. Cardigan moved into bed, raised himself to his elbows, yawned boisterously, cocked a sleepy eye at the illuminated dial of the clock on the bed table. He muttered, cursed, reached out. A glass and bottle went down from the table with a crash. The clock followed. And then Cardigan got his hand on the telephone, yanked it savagely across to the bed. He barked, "Hello? Yes? Hello? Mike? Who said so? Did he? And so I suppose, just because my name is alphabetically first, you wake me up out of a sound sleep? Listen, Mike, this is the second time in a week that tramp Murphy pulled the stunt. I know. He grumbled and he snapped. Okay. I'll go up. He pronged the receiver, found the bed light, and snapped it on. Getting out of bed, he took most of the covers with him. Two buttons were off his pajama coat, and one leg of his pajama pants was hitched up past the knee. His hair, at no time a barber's delight, was now a tousle shambles. He went growling and grumbling into the bathroom, gargled loud enough to be heard several apartments away. He dressed, slapped on his lop-eared hat, got the collar of his shaggy ulster inside instead of out, but went plodding down the corridor unaware. He was still only half awake by the time he reached the lobby. The cold winter night helped to rouse him, but in the Napoli and 40th Street, he drank a double scotch that went much further toward removing the cobwebs from his eyes. Then he took a cab, lounged back with a cigarette, and was swooped up and over the Park Avenue ramp. Five blocks farther north, in a side street off Park, the cab came to a halt. Cargan flipped the driver a half dollar, swung his long legs across the sidewalk, and punched in the heavy brass and mahogany swing door of the Hotel Gascon. He was quite awake by this time, but he still wore that somewhat sour expression of a man who has been roused from a sound sleep. He made his way long leg across the vast opulent lobby and reached the black marble and chrome desk where a dapper young man stood pensively pruning his fingernails. Cardigan said, "He get back?" "I beg pardon?" "Murphy, did he get back?" "I'm Cardigan from the agency." "Oh, I see," the man said, and then his face tightened irritably and he snapped. "This is the second time." "I know." "What time did he go out?" "At 10. And he said he would be right back, at least in time to make the midnight rounds. It seems to me..." "Okay, I'll make him." Cardigan went down a corridor, back of the desk, entered a small office, and hung up his hat and overcoat. The agency had been supplying the Gascon with a house detective for the past 2 months, and Murphy had been on the job nights for the past 2 weeks. Murphy, Cardigan knew, was a souse, and something of a ladies' man, and once before he'd gone out for a drink and not shown up until 3 hours later. Cardigan had wanted to fire him then, but his senior partner, George Hammerhorn, was by nature soft-hearted. It was 1:10 when Cardigan started on his rounds. He took an elevator to the top, the 22nd floor, got off, and walked the corridors, trying doors. Every door was supposed to be locked after midnight, and if it wasn't, it was the house officer's duty to knock and tell the occupant to lock his door. Cardigan worked his way down, poking into linen rooms, trying door after door. He found two unlocked by the time he reached the 18th floor. He toned down a drunken party on the 17th. On the 15th, he helped a drunk find his room. On the 13th, he found a husband who had been locked out by his wife. The 10th was all right until it came to one of the wings. The door of 1024 gave under his hand. He closed it again, then knocked. He received no response, and he knocked again. He waited another minute, then palmed the knob, turned it, and opened a door. Lights were glowing in a large apartment living room. He opened the door far enough to step into a small foyer, and then his bushy black eyebrows snapped downward. He reached behind him and pulled the door shut. There was a man lying face down in the center of the living room, one arm beneath his body, the other stretched out ahead. He had an overcoat on, but no hat. The hat was lying several feet beyond. Cardigan started toward the body, then stopped as he saw, lying in front of a broad divan at the opposite side of the room, a woman in a negligee. There came to his ears a faint sound like the faraway humming of a dynamo. His eyes cruised the room, stopped on a radio. It was evidently tuned in on a station that had gone off the air. His eyes dropped back to the man. He moved swiftly now, bent down, a grunt chopped out between his teeth. The man on the floor was Murphy, pale and handsome even in death. Cardigan gripped his body, lifted it, and saw that the hand beneath held a revolver, and he saw a large red blotch on Murphy's chest and on the carpet. He eased the body back to the floor. Cardigan stood up, his jaw hardening, a black shimmer coming into his eyes. The thick carpet muffled his footfalls as he crossed rapidly to the woman. She was young, slender, with a fine head of jet black hair, and she must have been very beautiful, alive. She was very dead now, a caked smear across her breast. Her negligee was torn in many places. Rising, his eyes took on a glassy, introspective stare. On a small table on one side of the divan, the side nearest the wall, he saw a shattered bowl. He leaned over and saw on the floor a square, leather-backed clock. He reached down and picked it up and found the lower part of it pierced. The hands had stopped at 11:03. He set the clock down on the table. He crossed to the radio, made a mental note of the station at which it was tuned, but did not touch the dials, nor did he turn off the switch. He found no other gun in the room. Crossing to the telephone, he picked it up and called the desk. "Who's registered in 1024? "I see. You'd better call the police." "Dead." "Yeah, dead. Murder, I guess." He hung up quietly. Molly Shane had lived a lifetime in 22 years. From the age of 15 onward, she had kicked, pirouetted, and cartwheeled her way across more stages than most people see in a normal lifetime. At various times, she had been the darling of Paris, London, Rio, and New York, a score of other cities. She had completed a circle. She had begun in New York and ended in New York. A bullet put an end to Molly Shane. "Doak," the plainclothes sergeant said. "It went right through her." He juggled a twisted lead slug he had picked up from the floor beneath the end table by the divan. He nodded. "Went through her and busted that bowl and busted that clock." "Stopped that clock at?" He nodded again. 3:11. It smacked her high between the breast. She could have been sitting or standing. Sitting on the divan, I mean. He tossed the slug, caught it. "It's 38, he said dully. He was a dour, disillusioned-looking man with a hard, medium-sized body. A hard, white nape. The man from the medical examiners said, "Oh, so," while bending over the body of Murphy. Dorigo, holding Murphy's gun by the end of the barrel, said, "Murder and suicide," and threw a sly, droll look toward Cardigan. Cardigan snorted and walked away into the bedroom, came back into the living room again, a mutinous, dark look in his eyes. The medical examiner's man said cheerfully, "You can see this fellow's coat is powder burned." "Two shells and this gun exploded," Dorigo drawled. "One in the Jane, one in Murphy." "It looks like suicide," the medical examiner's man sighed. Doak said to Cardigan, "Did Murphy know her?" "I don't know." "Sure he did," a voice rose from the depths of an armchair. It was Barney Evans' voice. He represented the Daily Call. His hand floated a cigarette around languidly. "Saw him, mean, saw him with her." "Where?" Doak growled. "Here and there. The Falstaff, for instance. She was dancing at the Falstaff, you know. Saw her at his table. He always got himself nice Janes." Cardigan snapped. "He made $40 a week. How the hell could he travel in this company?" "He had looks," Dorigo said, and bedroom eyes. The medical examiner's man stood up. The bullet's in him, of course. Ballistics will have to check up when we get it out of him. How long has he been dead? Cardigan asked. Let's see. It's 1:30 now. Oh, for the past 2 or 3 hours. We'll check up better later. Dorigo smiled. Sure. He turned the radio on. These rooms are supposed to be pretty soundproof, and the radio helped. A jazz band was on that station at that time. Not so swell for the dear old Cosmos Agency, huh, Cardigan? Why don't you bust out laughing and be done with it? Trouble with you, Iris, you can't take it. I'd call you a lousy Dago if I was sure that's the only kind of blood in you. Dorigo's eyes snapped, his nostrils quivered. Dope chopped in. Both you guys, lay off. The medical examiner's man pointed downward at the body. He was wearing a wristwatch on his left wrist. When he fell, I guess he smashed it. Cardigan took 3 long strides, knelt down. The glass face was gone, so were the hands. He found splinters of glass on the carpet where he had first seen Murphy's outstretched left hand lying. Later he found the hands, broken, twisted. The watch on Murphy's wrist was also shattered. Soundless, a corner of it had dug into his wrist. The medical examiner's man was saying, of course, he had been drinking. Sure, Dorigo snarled, still bristling under Cardigan's last taunt. He got tight and tried to make her, and when he couldn't, he let her have a slug. And then he saw what he did, and he put one into himself. I'm not surprised. The Cosmos Agency seems to pick its men up out of the gutters anyhow. Cardigan stood up, red color flooding his face. You keep your dirty mouth shut. You don't like that, do you, swell? Keep your mouth shut till you know more about this. And lay off the agency. We have to live on our salaries, and we don't ride around in swell cars that are bought with shakedown money. Watch your lip, Irish. I'll watch it when you watch yours. You ought to go back to South Brooklyn, where you made your first dough shaking down the burlesque houses. Shut up, Doak barked. Cardigan spun on him. Then tell this white trash to lay off me. I'll kick his face in if he opens it again. Dorigo was licking his lips. You'll... Damn it! You shut up too, Doak hammered out. Cardigan said crisply, I'm staying here till you get a fingerprint man up. When Murphy's taken to the morgue, I want his clothes and effects. Yes, sighed the medical examiner's man. I'd say it's murder and suicide. There's powder burns on Murphy's coat. And the way he fell, the way he was lying here with his gun hand doubled beneath him. He shrugged, sighed again. Of course, we have yet to see if the bullet inside him was fired from his gun. If it was, then of course that will, practically so to speak, convince me that it was murder and suicide. Of course, Dorigo snapped. This guy was hot after the dames. He was tight when he came in here. I'll tell you something, Cardigan cut in savagely. I'll tell you this. Even if you find that the bullet in his body was fired from his own gun, and the bullet that killed her was fired from the same gun, I'll tell you that even then, I won't believe it's murder and suicide. And why? Sneered Dorigo. Because? Simply because Murphy was a ladies' man. Because he had too many dames on the string to lose his head over one. Nuts? That's logic's nuts. Cardigan said, sure it is, to you. You can't see beyond your nose, Dorigo, and you've got a damn small nose at that. Part 2. Cardigan Discovers Poetry. George Hammerhorn, the broad, blonde, and blind head of the Cosmos Agency, was a man who affected gray tweeds and a stick. His cheeks were fleshy without being fat, and they were pink, and he had a kindly blue eye, a sound and genuine air about him. He came into the inner sanctum of the agency next morning more rapidly than was his custom. Patricia Seward was at his desk, sorting his mail, separating the chafe, the crank letters from the important matter of the day. Oh, Pat, he sighed gravely, hanging up stick, hat, and overcoat. That was a tough one. Pat was grave, too. Murphy, you mean? He nodded, sighed again, ran broad palms back over the speckled gray above his ears. He tossed a newspaper on the desk. See that song and dance? I read it over the tomato juice. That's dirty. He ground the heel of one hand into the palm of the other, stared hard at the desk. I don't like the implications. certain parties in the city have been trying for a long time to paint this agency as a collection of crooks. And it looks, he added, dropping his voice, that this time they get a break. Dorigo, huh? He nodded. She said, I was speaking with Cardigan on the phone about an hour ago. What'd he say? First, of course, he told me of a number of things he'd like to do to Detective Dorigo. Dorigo's had it in for him, for us, for a long time. What else did he say? That this would be a swell opportunity for someone to get an injunction against us. Close us up, take away our license to operate, but wait. He said to hold everything. Give no newspaper interviews. He said he was sure we'd get clear. He's over at headquarters now, I guess. Hammerhorn sat down side. Maybe I should have fired Murphy when Mark Cardigan wanted me to. It would have avoided this. And I suppose Murphy would still be alive. I wonder if he really did lose his head and do it. Pat said, of course, Murphy couldn't let a skirt go by. I wouldn't be surprised. Still, she broke off, shrugged, and said, I'm darned if I know. If he did it, Hammerhorn held up his hands. We're through as an agency. This new Civic Rights Commission will nail us. It was 11 a.m. when the outer door banged open. Heavy feet hit the floor and Cardigan came plowing into the inner sanctum. His face was wind-reddened. His lop-eared hat rode crazily over one ear and he was eating an apple. Hammerhorn laid down a pen, leaned back, folded his hands on his stomach and said nothing. The news, said Cardigan in a heavy jocular tone, is not the kind you'll be crazy about. Autopsy? Yeah. Cardigan bit into the word with a grim smile. It was Murphy's gun. Did both jobs. Revelation threw that nice face bum Dorigo into a spring dance and gave me a bellyache. But wait, he said roughly, as Hammerhorn wagged his head. I got over the bellyache right away. How about the time of death? They say both at approximately the same time at 11. Hammerhorn's voice tightened. That's bad. Bad. On the face, George, it's lousy. We're in for it, Jack. Cardigan chuckled. Sure we're in for it. It's no laughing matter. Listen, George. I haven't begun to sink my teeth into this thing yet. What the hell? Give Dorigo rope. He's wanted to hang me for a long time. And just now he's foaming at the mouth for purity light. Okay, let him. Let the South Brooklyn punk go gaga. I've been around, George, and I pinched the passkey to late Molly Shane's apartment. I like to let the cops fan a place first. I can always depend on it. They take the worthless and overlook the worthwhile. How about fingerprints? Cardigan, sitting down, shook his head. They didn't find any but hers, Murphy's, and the maid's. Ouch. Buck up. Cardigan drew a paper packet from his overcoat pocket, unsnapped the rubber band. Molly was a poet in her spare time. A pretty awful poet, but still a poet. I snagged her scrapbook. It's interesting. After each little poem, she put a date. Here's one written 2 weeks ago. You're my light and you're my darkness. Chains of love and chains of darkness. The stars, the moon, the restless sea. But you will be the death of me. It rhymes, Hammerhorn said. It's punk. Get this. You came out of the night, dark-eyed, and though I tried and tried and tried to ward you off, you followed me till I was lost, no longer free. Hammerhorn said, but what does it mean? She loved him. Swallowed this one. Your clothes, the boutonniere you wear, the sheen of your dark midnight hair, the pirate's life you leave, the ice and blood of you, and mine the price. That girl had things on her mind, Jack. You're telling me? And just two more lines. Listen. The blood you've taken here and there is like the ruby that you wear. Cardigan slapped the scrapbook shut. Hammerhorn said, did the cops see that? Dorigo thumbed it and chucked it down. Now wait. The dress she wore last night when she came in was lying across a chair in her bedroom. In the bodice of it, I found a few bits of confetti. On the flesh, just below her elbow, the part she leaned on at a table, I saw an imprint. The letters IAM. Ink. The ink of some lettering, as though some card or paper was wet when she leaned on it and the print came off on her arm. This is not to prove that she hadn't washed yet when she was killed. She probably came home, got undressed, or almost. Her underclothes were still on, and then put on a negligee to admit whoever came in. I saw these letters on her arm before the medical man came. In handling her, he must have rubbed them off. How about the elevator boys at the hotel? There was a dance in the hotel at the time, and a lot of people were going up and down in the elevators. She wasn't noticed. My contention is that she came home early from wherever she was, in a tantrum maybe, and that whoever she was with, he followed later. But where does Murphy fit in? The hotel desk said she didn't call for help. Murphy wouldn't have been in the halls at the time unless he'd been called. How do you figure him in it? I can't yet. If I could, the case might be a snap. The afternoon papers cut loose with a flock of pictures of Molly Shane ran stick on stick of highly spiced high points of the life of the late dancer. There'd been a lot of men in her life, but scandal had not touched her. Dig as the scandal mongers did, they found nothing in her career worth pitching at an I told you so public. The conservative sheets remained conservative. The yellows gagged themselves on adjectives and superlatives, were strong for the murder and suicide theory because it was colorful. One writer hashed up an imaginary playlet of how the crime had happened. News trickled in and kept trickling to add to the stated fact that Chris Murphy knew Molly Shane well. The whys and wherefores were traced back 5 years at a time when Murphy, working for another agency, had been engaged to guard Molly Shane against the advances of a psychopathic young man who was later jugged on a Westchester attack charge and was still in the jug. More recently, Murphy had been seen with Molly Shane in the Falstaff and in a number of small, out-of-the-way eating places. With no evidence to the contrary, a verdict was handed down that Murphy, in a drunken rage, had tried to attack Molly Shane, and being repulsed, had shot her to death and then committed suicide. To the rank and file, it was open and shut. This line was particularly significant. Christopher Murphy, who at the time of his death was a private detective in the employ of the Cosmos Agency. The Hotel Gascon, bristling, intended to begin suit for damages against the Cosmos Agency. "We're sunk," George Hammerhorn said. "You see now the beginning of the end of the Cosmos Agency." "My eye," said Cardigan. At this moment, William H.K. Plunkett, attorney for the agency, came in with his bats and his walking stick and blew his nose zestfully. He was a 110-pound fashion plate, aged 50, with more brain matter than any one man deserved. "Good news," he said. "The attorney for the Civic Rights Commission apprised me of the fact that your dear old agency is to be ransacked." "Clear that up," Hammerhorn said. "They're applying for a court order to investigate your files and to cross-examine every man and woman in your employ. Also, of course, the wanted injunction to prohibit further operations on your part." "So what?" "Send your employees to Capri for the winter and burn the old office down." "Seriously, I mean." "Oh, don't worry about it. I'll just get an injunction against their injunction, and I'll try to make them show reason why. Because one of your employees committed a crime in no way connected with the agency? Why, in consequence thereof, the agency should be submitted to the humiliation of an inquest, and so on and so forth. But don't go in a funk. Remember, prosperity's just around the corner." He leaned over, whispered, "And if there happens to be anything in your files, you understand, that might cause a furrowed brow, well, expunge, take it out, delete. There's nothing in our files I'm afraid of." "Good," Plunkett twirled his stick. "Well, so long, toodaloo, off we'd have been." Swishing out, he bumped into Pat Seward. "Ah, Patricia, how about supper some night?" "Make it lunch, and I'll know you're on the level." "But Patricia, I am." She smiled good-humoredly. "I know, like an escalator." Part 3. Rigotti. Cardigan, stretching his legs up the dark street, hugged the buildings. For the rain was hard, a steady downpour threshing on the sidewalk, making silver needles around the streetlights. Ahead, he saw a white blob of light suspended above a door. Reaching it, he turned and ducked down 3 stone steps. The door opened as he reached for it. A small man barged out, and Cardigan, stopping short, dipped his head as the small man, also stopping short, looked upward. A half pint of water was jerked from the hollow in the crown of Cardigan's hat and flung neatly into the small man's face. "I beg your pardon," said Cardigan. The man sputtered and cursed and bounded up the steps, hailed a cab. Inside, a swart fat girl reached for Gardigan's hat, but he shook his head, went through the anteroom, and passed into a bright, prosperous-looking bar. The Rome was supposed to be one of the flashier speaks in the Sheridan Square neighborhood. Three bartenders were on duty, and between 20 and 30 men stood at the bar. Nearby was an elaborate free lunch counter, and facing the bar was a broad frescoed archway that opened into a large dining room that tried to look like an Italian garden, with its fountains, its synthetic trees and vines, and its mandolin-playing troubadour, who from time to time sang from a vine-clad balcony. There was no dancing. Here came the local politicians, the men and the money, some celebrities from Broadway and the 40s. The prices were high, the main reason why Cardigan knew next to nothing about it, or its personnel. He ordered a rye highball and drank it down before saying to the bartender, "Who's the manager here?" "You want to see him?" "That's right." The bartender craned his neck. "See that fountain in there? He's standing in front of it." "What's his name?" "Rigotti." Among the slick and well-groomed men, Cardigan stuck out like a sore thumb. His hat, more lop-eared than ever because of the rain, was a disgrace. His ulster looked soggy and had the pungent smell which genuine wool takes on when wet, and the damp made his thick hair bunch and curl eloquently about his ears and on his nape. "Rigotti, my name's Cardigan, and I want to talk to you." Rigotti had a face like a hard-boiled egg that had been shelled. It shone, but not with delight. "About what?" "Your office will do, or the washroom." "What's the matter with right here?" "Nothing, except that I want to talk to you alone." "I don't get you. Ever hear of the Cosmos Agency?" "Yeah, I'm half of it." Rigotti jerked his chin, and Cardigan followed him along the wall, through a doorway into a small cleared office. Rigotti closed the door, looked at his fingernails, said without looking up, "What's on your mind?" "On the night of January 22nd, Rigotti, what kind of a party was thrown here?"
"Here?"
"Yeah." "Nothing. Your memory's lousy. You ordered a batch of paper hats, those paper ribbons you tossed, some noisemakers and confetti. You ordered them from the Star Comic Novelty Company for the 22nd. They hadn't arrived by noon, and you or somebody else here telephoned and said you had to have them for that night."
"Oh, that. Yes, I remember. So what?"
"Hell, is this the only place had stuff sent that day?"
"No.
There were 21 others, and I've been around to 17. I just asked you a question."
"What was the question?"
"I told you yes, and... I mean, Rigotti, who threw the party?"
"It was just a kind of celebration on our part."
"Public?"
"Yeah."
"Out in your dining room, huh?"
"Sure."
Cardigan laughed. "Come on, Rigotti. Lay off that."
"Lay off what?"
"A girl I know was down here on the night of the 22nd, and there was no public party." Rigotti stood back on his heels. His eyes became dull as they settled on Cardigan's face. "You know a lot, don't you?"
"Not half as much as I'd like to know. Who threw the party?"
"I don't know."
"It was thrown upstairs, wasn't it, in a private banquet room?"
"Maybe it was." Rigotti's face was cold. He turned. "I got a job to take care of."
Cardigan stepped in his way.
"So have I."
Rigotti's thick upper lip quivered. Tried to curl like a wolf's, didn't quite succeed, he said.
"You heard me."
He picked up a menu card from the desk, started for the door again.
Cardigan ripped the card from his hand.
"Listen to me."
The door opened and two bull-necked waiters stood there.
Rigotti said, "Toss him out."
"Quit it," Cardigan snapped. He added, "I'll walk."
"You're wise," Rigotti said.
Cardigan flung him a dark look, shoulder between the two waiters, and made his way to the bar. He did not stop. He went through the anteroom, opened the door, climbed the steps, and lunged through the rain into a taxi cab parked at the curb.
"Drive east," he said.
He sat back, wiped the rain from his face, and then suddenly found that he still had the menu card he had ripped from Rigotti's hand. Switching on the cab's dome light, he squinted at the card, at the printing at the top. Benjamino's, the Rome. He squinted hard, and a dark, intense light came into his eyes. He thought back. Molly Shane's arm, just below the elbow. He looked down again at the card. Benjamino's. Cardigan got out of the cab in Grove Street, where streetlights are few and far between, ducked across the sidewalk, down six stone steps into a black well of an areaway.
The iron gate was ajar, and he pushed open the heavy wooden door beyond, tramped down a wide, uncarpeted corridor, and took a swing door into a high-ceilinged, old-fashioned bar. "Rye highball, Chip," he said.
"Swell weather out, huh? For ducks."
"Paper says fair tomorrow. I see a guy of yours up and pulled himself off a crime of passion."
"You don't want to believe everything you hear in the papers, Chip."
"Meow," sighed a voice nearby. Cardigan turned and saw Barney Evans of the Daily Call with his face in a glass of beer. Cardigan smiled grimly, dagger-eyed. "There is a howling example of what I mean."
"Anyhow," belched Evans, "I'm good to my mother, and I lead blind old men across crowded streets. I also sing hymns. Want me to sing a hymn?"
"Listen, Lug," Cardigan said, grabbing his arm. "Come over here a minute."
He piloted the rubber-kneed reporter to a booth at the far end of the bar and shoved him down onto one of the benches. He took the bench opposite, and the table was between them. Evans promptly got the hiccups. Cardigan went to the bar and came back with a glass of water. He made Evans stand up, told him to bend way over and drink from the opposite side of the glass. Evans did this, and his hiccups vanished. He sat down, grimacing. "Water's bad for the system. Now listen, Barney. You're a lousy sauce-pot, but I like you. And there's a break that maybe we can split two ways. I don't bet on the horses anymore. The horses I follow always follow other horses. Shut up and give your ears a chance. Listen, you know the roan, don't you?"
"Otto. Wasn't I tossed out once for singing hymns?"
"And you know Rigotti?"
"Yeah. Nice guy, nice, I mean, like a snake in the grass. He doesn't like hymns."
"Listen, Barney, listen now. On the night of the 22nd, where was I? Why, playing checkers with my mother."
Cardigan groaned. He drummed on the table, bent a dark, exasperated stare at Evans, and finally snapped.
"You listen? Proceed."
Cardigan leaned way over the table. "On the night of the 22nd, there was a hidey-ho party thrown at Benjamino's Rome. Upstairs. Private. You hear? Party. 22nd. Rome."
"Good. Now, do you know who threw it?"
"Let me see. Nope, I don't."
"Any way you can find out?"
"Ha.
Trying to put me on my mettle, huh?"
"Talk sense. Can you find out?"
"I can check up."
Listen, write it down, will you? Here, write it on this hunk of paper. Write, who threw party at Rome, night of 22nd. That's so I won't forget in case I get drunk."
"In case you get drunk? You're plastered now."
"Phooey, that's just an optical illusion of yours."
Cardigan wrote, as Evans directed, and when he looked up, the reporter was sound asleep.
Cardigan did not rouse him. He slipped the note in Barney's vest pocket, the pocket containing his watch, so that it would not be overlooked. He walked back to the bar and set down his glass as DeRigo came in. DeRigo's face warped in a sly, amused smile, and he came the last few steps lightly on the balls of his feet, put his tongue archly in his cheek.
"Got a new job in mind, Cardigan?"
"You'll be out of a job before I will, DeRigo."
"Quoth he drawled to the bartender. "Scotch, Chip. Give Cardigan one, too. I want to drink his health."
Cardigan said, "Pass it up, Chip."
"Tender, huh?" DeRigo drawled. "Don't like to drink with your betters, right?
Betters?"
DeRigo smiled, his eyes drooping.
Cardigan tilted his jaw, said, "I hear you laid down in a gutter once, and a rat got up and walked away."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. Another rat came along and lay down beside you, and the first rat saw him and went off and told all the other rats. And the other rats got together and said, 'You must cast our brother from us. He lay in a gutter with one named DeRigo.'"
DeRigo colored, and his collar suddenly seemed too tight for him. A muddy look came into his eyes, and his nostrils quivered.
"And if you don't like that," Cardigan said, "say so, and ask me to take it back, and see if I'll take it back."
"Someday, Irish," DeRigo grated, "you'll go too far."
"When I do, it'll take a couple of good surgeons to fix up that pan of yours." He looked DeRigo up and down, laughed scornfully, pivoted and swung his long legs out of the bar. Part 4, Murder by the Clock. At 9 next morning, Cardigan walked into the Fifth Avenue jewel firm of Abbott and Mars. An elegant young man met him at the door, and Cardigan caught a whiff of cipher and said, "Mr. Abbott in? Who shall I say is calling?"
"Cardigan of the Cosmos Agency."
"A little moment, please. Just a little moment. Cardigan grinned to himself. Wandered around the shop. In a minute, the elegant young man reappeared, beckoned. Cardigan walked to the rear of the store, climbed a short circular staircase to a mezzanine, and entered a large, luxurious office. "Hello there, Cardigan," old Abbott said. "I see your agency is being taken for a ride. So I suppose we'll lose your account? Not until you fold up. That what you came about?" "Nope. I finally managed to get Murphy's effects from the cops, and I'd like you to help me and keep it secret." He drew a small wad of tissue paper from his pocket, opened it, and laid Murphy's shattered wristwatch on the desk. That broke when Murphy fell on the floor. The glass was shattered, and the hands fell off. The hands broke, too. "What I want is this. I want to see if you can tell just when this watch stopped. Can you?"
"I guess so. I can replace the hands. You see, the hour hand would go on first, and then the minute hand. The hole of the hour hand is a little large, and it's not really a hole, but a small oblong that will fit only two ways. I mean, if I just put the hands on haphazardly, fitting it over the small bar, it might be 12. I could lift it off, turn it around, put it on again, and it would be 6, but nothing else. It would have to be exactly opposite. The same with the minute hand. It could be placed in only two positions. If placed at 11:45 or 11:45, the opposite would only be 11:45, you see?"
"I catch on. I'll take it down the lab and see if I can fit a couple of hands. I'll do it personally."
"Swell. You'll wait?"
"Yeah, I'll wait."
It was 20 minutes later when Cardigan left the shop. He stood for a moment on the curb outside, the wind clapping the skirt of his ulster and humming past his hat. He turned at last and headed south, swung west at 33rd and wound up at Herald Square. He spent a minute or two cogitating, then went on west past Macy's, reached 7th Avenue and entered Penn Station. He made a couple of telephone calls from a booth, one to the office and one to Barney Evans. Benjamino threw the party Cardigan, and listen, I'll tell you how I found out. Max Schmel runs a photographer's shop on the 6th north of Waverly, and I knew he did all the photography for those joints around here. Listen, Cardigan. Cardigan, listen. Made a few notes on the margin of a paper of the telephone directory, hung up, tore out the page, and whistled his way blithely out of the booth. He went downstairs in the terminal, caught a West Side subway train south, and got off at the station marked Christopher Street and Sheridan Square. He crossed the square, went up Grove Street, turned right into Waverly Place, followed it to 6th Avenue, and turned north beneath the elevated structure. Max Schmel's was a hole in the wall. Up front was a glass box containing pictures of the local swains and belles and of chubby little bambinos, immense Italian housewives, a locally prominent plumber, and a late alderman. "On the night of the 22nd, Cardigan said, "you went over to Benjamino's room." Max was a young, knotty-haired man who wore large, dark-rimmed spectacles. "Sure. I went over and took a flashlight picture of a private party Benjamino was throwing."
"Yeah.
How many were there?"
"I don't remember, but I got a picture here."
Cardigan nodded, smiling. "Yeah, that's what I want to see." Max disappeared into a rear room, came back in a couple of minutes saying, "Yeah, I got several here." He placed 3 large glossy prints on the counter. "I took them from different angles."
Cardigan switched on a light above his head, lifted the photographs. Carefully, shutter-eyed, he scrutinized each picture. He used an index finger to count the number of persons seated at the long banquet table. He tapped a picture he now held and said, "I noticed 2 chairs here side by side are empty. I guess maybe them 2 didn't come? What time did you take these pictures?"
"Oh, about 10, I know. I left here at 9:30.
"Got a magnifying glass?"
"Yeah."
Cardigan screwed the glass into his eye pier.
He said.
"What?"
Cardigan said. "Mind if I borrow one of these?"
"Sure, go ahead.
Remember, keep this under your hat."
"That's what Barney Evans said."
"Sure.
Barney gives me lots of breaks. Tips me off about hot subjects, accidents or something, and I run off and take the pictures and clean up something, selling them to the papers hot."
Cardigan went out and in a drugstore used a phone booth to call Barney Evans. He said,
"Can you get a big sedan?"
"Okay.
Get it now and meet me in 30 minutes at 6 in Waverly. I'll tell you when you get here."
"Are you drunk?"
"You would be."
He hung up,
bought a nickel cigar and strolled down 6th. He stopped at the corner of Waverly, stood looking down at the photograph of Benjamino's party. He recognized several faces, a local two-fisted politician, Benjamino's grinning, regarding the background, an ex-judge not considered a potent political gun without portfolio. But mainly Cardigan's gaze dwelt on the two empty chairs. On the table in front of these chairs, two persons had eaten. He saw two wine glasses, half empty, two rumpled napkins, bits of food on two plates. Pat Seward was drawing a tumbler of water from the ice cooler in the inner sanctum, and George Hammerhorn was figuring up his bank balance when a rattle and clatter sounded in the outer office. Miss Myrtle O'Hara, the stenographer, opened the glass-paneled connecting door and then jumped out of the way, and Cardigan came in carrying an armchair. Behind him, with another, came Barney Evans, puffing and groaning. The chairs were heavy, seated, and backed with dark red leather. Barney plunked his down and staggered towards the cooler. "Water! Water!" he cried. He stopped short, staggered round, shook his head. "No! No! Spirits! Spirits!" George Hammerhorn gave him a drink of scotch. "What the hell kind of a picnic is this?" Cardigan said. "Is Engel in?" "Back in the lab." "Good," Hammerhorn said. "But what are you doing with those chairs?" Barney Evans burst into a fit of laughter and walked round and round the office holding his stomach. Cardigan was deadly serious. "We got them upstairs in the Rome, that place Benjamino runs. Nobody there at this hour. Got Barney to drive around with a sedan, and then we broke in the joint, got up to this banquet room and snitched these chairs." Barney fell into a chair, still laughing. "But why?" George Hammerhorn said. "Why the chairs?" Cardigan pointed. "Fingerprints. I want to see if Engel can get off some fingerprints. I've got it in my nut that Molly Shane and a guy were at Benjamino's party. I want to see if Molly's prints are on one of these chairs. I want," he added, "to see whose prints are on the other." "How do you know these are the chairs?" "I'm guessing. They were the only two unoccupied chairs when the picture was taken. A photographer took a flashlight. This," he said, tossing the photograph to the desk. "The leather back of each chair is tooled differently. You can see the variations in the photograph with a magnifying glass." Cardigan called in Engel and said, "Take these two chairs, Pete, and see what kind of prints you get off. Look particularly on the arms, where a person would naturally grab to shift the chair back when getting up. But look all over." Hammerhorn had begun to sweat. "Do you realize this is burglary?" Cardigan was offhand. "Sure. And don't you realize that if we twiddle our thumbs, the grand old Cosmos Agency is going up the flue?" "Faint made," Barney said dramatically. "Never won fair heart, to quote the scriptures. I got a swell new hymn." "Please, Barney," said Pat, "no hymns." She sighed, looked at Cardigan. "Anyhow, it's a relief. It wasn't a bar you wanted." At 3 that afternoon, Pat was holding down the inner sanctum when she heard voices in the outer office. She looked up as Miss Myrtle O'Hara opened the connecting door and began to stutter. "That's okay, Miss," plainclothes Sergeant Doakes said, coming in. Dorigo sauntered after him, and Doakes said bluntly, "Where's your boss, Miss Seward?" "I'm on deck, Sergeant." "Well, there was a place busted into down near Sheridan Square this morning, and a couple of chairs stolen." Dorigo, rocking on his heels, stared. "Yeah, and we're looking for that big Turk, Cardigan." "I'm sorry," said Pat sweetly. "He's not in." She added, "Would you like to leave a message?" Doak was blunt. "No, we came here looking for the chairs." "How ridiculous." "Can that," Dorigo said. "But why," Pat said, "would Cardigan steal a couple of chairs?" Doak said, "Rigotti, the guy manages the place, seems to think it was Cardigan. And anyhow, we're looking for them here." "So sorry," Pat sing-songed. "Were they expensive?" "This Jane's horsing us," Dorigo snapped. "Come on, let's fan the joint." "Wait," Doak said, holding out his arm and to Pat. "Suppose you show us around, Miss Seward." "I tell you it's absurd, Sergeant. Please believe me." Dorigo snarled. "She's horsing us. Come on." Pat jumped up, her eyes flashing. "You get out of here. There are no chairs here, I told you. If you want to search this place, you know where to get a warrant." Dorigo laughed. "She learned those cracks from Cardigan. Come on, Doak, what the hell?" He started for the other door. Pat jumped in his way, and Dorigo, vicious-eyed, struck her down. Doak looked disapprovingly at him but said nothing. Pat jumped up, and as DeRigo swung the door open, Pat picked up a glass paperweight and bounced it off his head. DeRigo swung and came at her, but Doak, cool and hard-faced, stopped him. Doak muttered, "Cut it, DeRigo," and shoved him onto the laboratory. Engel said, "What's the row?" Doak and DeRigo went through the laboratory, looked in closets in the photographic darkroom. DeRigo swiveled and snapped at Engel. "Where the hell's those chairs?" Engel was innocent face. "Chairs?" "You heard me. Chairs!" Doak said, "Come on, DeRigo. They're not here. Come on, I tell you." DeRigo went hotly back into the office and Pat said, "If I wanted to be real mean, DeRigo, I could tell Cardigan about that pass you made at me and then inform a hospital of an impending disaster." Doak hustled DeRigo out. Pat turned to Engel. "What happened?" "I heard them," Engel said. He turned and pointed to a round glass window. "I tied the chairs to a rope, hung them in the shaftway." Pat fanned herself. "Whew! Did you use your head?" Part 5, Roman Holiday. Cardigan came out of the subway kiosk at Christopher Street in Sheridan Square. The wind lifted a sheet of newsprint from the sidewalk and plastered it against his face. He yanked it off and the wind caught it, kited it away. He cut across the square, went up Grove Street to West 10th. He walked on, stretching his long legs, his hands jammed into the pockets of his shaggy ulster, a butt jutting from one side of his mouth, and his lop-eared hat crammed low down on his forehead, with brim up like a cowboy's riding into the wind. He saw ahead the yellow blob of light that marked the Rome. He reached the door, pinched his butt between thumb and forefinger, and snapped it out into the middle of the street. He dropped down the steps, palmed the door open, and towered into the anteroom. The fat girl reached for his hat and coat. He shook his head, said, "Uh-uh," and passed on into the bar. It was a little past 6, and a cocktail crowd was in the bar. The shakers were going fast, and the troubadour was singing Valencia to a handful of persons in the dining room. Cardigan dropped his elbows on the bar. "Sidecar," he told the bartender. He drowned the sidecar at 3 gulps, cleared his throat, and felt better. He paid for the drink, saw Rigotti standing in the dining room entry, and went toward him. "In your office, Rigotti. Come on." "So you're here again? And you're going to see a lot of me. Come on. I've got the words, and I've got the music. Take it outside." Cardigan got close to him, looked darkly down into Rigotti's muddy eyes. "I'm here on business. Get in your office." Rigotti shrugged and led the way into the little office, and Cardigan kicked the door shut, unbuttoned his overcoat, and dug his hands into his pants pocket. He said with deadly calm, "I want to see Benjamino." "You could have asked me that out there." "I want," said Cardigan, "to see Benjamino in here. Go get him." The door opened and DeRigo came in, closed the door, leaned back against it, said, "I saw that little play." Cardigan jerked a thumb. "You're not wanted." A waiter opened the door, beckoned to Rigotti. "Just a minute, boss." "I'll be back," Rigotti said, and followed the waiter out. Cardigan sat on the edge of the desk, dangled a leg. "DeRigo," he said, "you're going to get your nose dirty if you hang around. I'd like to know who piled in here this morning and hoisted 2 of the Rome's Spanish chairs. Burglary, you know. Is that right? Well, why don't you find out?" "I'm trying now." Cardigan stood up, took his hands out of his pocket, and went over to face DeRigo. "Copper, when I see you, I see red. You're in my way tonight. I'm a wild mick on the loose, and I'm warning you. Take the air before I step on you. You're breaking your neck to bust me and bust up George's agency. You're dirty about it, but that doesn't surprise me, because you're dirty anyhow. You hear me? Stay the hell out of my way." DeRigo's eyes were dark, his mouth and his nostrils twitched. "I'll break you and the agency. How do you like that?"
"I hate it."
"Swell." Cardigan hit him. All the accrued hatred and bile came out in the form of a big fist driven chopped upward. DeRigo said, "Ooh," quietly, and his knees buckled, his eyes rolled and showed the whites as he slumped downward. Cardigan picked him up, shook him. DeRigo's eyes rolled and he cursed, staggered back and forth on his feet. Cardigan held his arm firmly, steadied him. He opened the door. By main strength, he guided DeRigo to the bar, piloted him through to the anteroom, got him out into the street. He opened the door of a waiting taxicab and hoisted DeRigo in. Dorigo slumped back into the seat. Cardigan slipped the driver bill. Take my friend to Grand Central. He's plastered and has to make a train.
Okay, Chief.
The cab drove off. Cardigan stood on the curb, brushed his hands together, whistled a few bars and went back into the room. He didn't see Rigotti in the bar or in the dining room. He walked through the dining room, pulled back curtains aside, and found himself in a corridor. There was a broad staircase, which he mounted a few steps at a time, listening. He reached the corridor above. Moving from door to door, he listened at each. He was halfway down the corridor when he heard a door open and saw Rigotti appear further down the hallway. Rigotti closed the door and took half a dozen steps before he saw Cardigan. Then he stopped short, his features tightening, freezing. He came on swiftly, his fists clenched, his brows bent in a sudden furious scowl.
"Who the hell told you to come up here?" he snarled.
"Don't show your teeth at me, Rigotti. Where's Benjamino?"
"You get downstairs."
"Why should I?
And come up again?"
"This is private up here," Rigotti rasped, his eyes blazing. "Get down!"
Cardigan grinned. "Now listen, Rigotti."
Rigotti shot a hand towards his hip. Cardigan grabbed, caught Rigotti's wrist. He shifted his feet quickly, tightened his loins, his bent arm hardened, lifted while it corkscrewed upward. Rigotti rose from the floor, gritting his teeth, his body supported by his bent arm. Suddenly, Cardigan relaxed. Rigotti's bar dropped a couple of inches, and then Cardigan's arm did a whip snap, and instantly Rigotti was flat on his face. He pawed for his gun. His hand didn't seem to work properly. Cardigan said, "I sprained your wrist, Rigotti. You're wasting time trying to get that gun." He reached down, took the gun from Rigotti's pocket, thrust it into his own. He left Rigotti panting and aching for breath and still on the floor. Below, the troubadour was singing Marchetta. Cardigan came up to the door through which he had seen Rigotti emerge. He grasped the knob with his left hand, turned it. He opened a door and walked into a large old room furnished with large modern pieces at odds with the Georgian fireplace.
"Take your time, Benjamino," he clipped.
A luscious little redhead, all hosiery and white shoulders, was sitting in fat, swart Benjamino's lap. Benjamino had a fat wife and 10 bambinos uptown. The redhead, taking one look at Cardigan, grabbed fat Benjamino round the neck and cried, "Oh, Popsy Wopsy!" Cardigan let a low, brittle chuckle escape.
"Popsy Wopsy?"
Benjamino ordinarily had the face of a fat angel, but now it showed a mixture of anger, fear, and embarrassment. Cardigan's smile vanished. His face grew cold.
"Chase the dame, Benjamino," he said.
"Ah, I'd say you're Cardigan."
"That's right.
Now chase her." Benjamino, his fat eyes fixed on Cardigan, patted the redhead's shoulder, urged her away with a movement of his body. Goggle-eyed, she fled across the room, while Cardigan looked over from head to foot and said, as a girl went out and closed the door, "You pick him, you old playboy, you."
Benjamino looked breathless, mournful.
"What do you want?"
"I want..." He paused, came a few steps closer, showed his teeth in a hard, brazen smile.
Benjamino gulped. "Yes?
Can't guess, huh?"
"No."
"Joe Palermo."
Benjamino's fat, swart face seemed to jounce once and then was motionless and mournful, saggy-eyed.
"Joe Palermo," he said in a faraway whisper.
"Joe Palermo,"
Cardigan said matter-of-factly now.
Benjamino giggled, made a silly gesture.
"Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, you mean Joe Palermo.
Joe Palermo, you mean."
"Yeah."
"Yeah," Benjamino giggled. "Have a drink?"
"I'll have Joe Palermo instead."
Benjamino groped his feet, coughed, blew through his teeth, made a silly gesture, said, Yes, I'll have a drink."
Cardigan stepped between him and the table.
"I'm in a hurry, Benjamino. Where's Palermo?"
"Well, you see, I don't just know where Joe is."
Cardigan's voice hardened.
"Benjamino, I want Palermo. He was here at a banquet on the night of the 22nd.
"Yes, sure he was here.
He was here all right.
"What time did he leave?"
"Oh, about 2 a.m.
"What time did he come here?"
8:30.
Cardigan grinned ironically.
"Got his alibi all fixed, huh?"
"Look now, Cardigan.
You're lying like hell.
Because Palermo left during the banquet, you dumb potato."
Benjamino said dramatically.
"There's 20 men and women."
"No, he didn't.
They're liars, too."
He stopped short, remained silent for a moment, then his voice rushed out violently. Me and the agency I work for are headed for the rocks. I'm not crazy about my job, but I have to eat, and I'm damned if I'm going to lose it. And I want, you fat Italian sugar daddy, I want Palermo. I don't want any arguments, and I don't care how many people say he didn't leave your banquet. I know he did. I want him. You hear? He whipped out the gun he had taken from Rigotti and jammed it hard against Benjamino's middle. His voice chopped. Get him. Phone him. Get him here. No. Cardigan rushed him halfway across the room. Benjamino landed in an armchair so hard that he almost bounced out again. His jowls jounced. Mother of God, Cardigan. I want him, Cardigan snarled. Get up. He yanked Benjamino out of the chair, turned him, pressed the gun against the back of Benjamino's neck. I want him, Benjamino, he snarled. It was dissimulated madness that frightened, horrified the Italian. He stumbled to the telephone, dialed a number, the instrument shook in his hands. Joe, this is Benjamino. I got to see you. Quick. He hung up and groaned. He gulped. Let me get out of here. Wait. The door whipped open and Dorigo stood there with his gun drawn. Drop it, Irish. Cardigan looked over his shoulder. Dorigo rasped. Drop it or move. Move an inch, baby, and I'll let you have it. I like it. Cardigan let the gun drop to the floor. Dorigo was breathless. Send me on a buggy ride to Grand Central, will you? Okay, smart guy. This is a pinch. Cardigan had turned. For socking an officer of the law? Yeah, for socking an officer of the law. I'll see you spend 6 months in that can for this. Cardigan raised his palms, went towards Dorigo. Now wait a minute. I can't be pinched right now. I'm on a job. Dorigo was simmering. His eyes were blazing and his voice shook with suppressed passion. You heard me, Cardigan. I've stood enough from you. Enough. You're going over to headquarters and you're going to spend the night there. He snapped up his chin, steadied his gun. Get out in the hall. Dorigo, listen. Get out, rasped Dorigo. Shut your mouth. I don't want to hear a word out of you. Benjamino, at first shocked, now breathed in deeply and looked like a man who had been told his world would end and then found that it would not. But he said nothing. His jowls quivered with excitement. Cardigan walked into the hall, passing Dorigo and looking down at him with dark, malignant intensity began. I just... Shut up! Cardigan inhaled deeply, held his breath, then let it out slowly, sighing hopelessly. His face became red with chagrin, his eyes sultry and mutinous. Dorigo, he knew, was mad to the core, bitter and resentful and determined to make him, Cardigan, pay in full for past victories and abuses. Dorigo was on top, riding the crest, Cardigan thought. I'm a fool, a sap. I should never have pasted that guy. He reached the head of the staircase, saw a group of waiters waiting expectantly below. The troubadour was singing The Peanut Vendor. Dorigo, for crying out loud. Dorigo struck Cardigan a blow on the head, and Cardigan involuntarily took 3 steps down. His face grew darker, redder, and he licked his lips. Felt himself beginning to sweat as he walked down the stairway. He reached the bottom, looked straight ahead as he walked past the waiters. He heard a few snickers and one Bronx cheer. His face was taking on a very dark red color, and his eyes seemed to become bloodshot. Rigotti hissed. I'll send you some ice cream, Cardigan, and put arsenic in it. Cardigan did not move his head. He walked through the dining room, passed into the bar. Dorigo was behind him, a step behind him. He turned and faced Dorigo, and his big face was warped. I tell you, Dorigo, I came here to make a mug. Get on, rasped Dorigo. Cardigan turned and headed for the anteroom, but the man coming into the bar made Cardigan stop. He felt Dorigo's gun prod him in the back, but he did not budge. The man was young, dark-clothed, darkly handsome. He held a cigarette in his mouth, and a large ruby shone redly on his small finger. A flower was in his lapel. Palermo, Cardigan muttered. The man had not noticed him. He was making his way swiftly toward the dining room. Get, snapped Dorigo, but Cardigan raised his jaw. Palermo, he barked. The sleek young man spun. Cardigan turned on Dorigo. There's your man, Dorigo. Nab him. There's Joe Palermo. Palermo was unaware of the situation that existed between Dorigo and Cardigan. He did not know Cardigan, but he must have known that Dorigo was a detective, and he saw the gun in Dorigo's hand. He saw the savage, bitter, murderous look on Dorigo's face, but he did not know that it was meant for Cardigan and not for him. Joe Palermo made one sleek dive, twisted as he ran toward the door through which he had just come. He must have had things on his mind. Metal flashed in his hand and his gun boomed. Women screamed. Dorigo looked silly, made a wry face, shook himself, took one step forward, one backward, then turned around like a dog sitting down, and sat down. Cardigan's hand sliced beneath the left lapel of his coat. He started off, drawing his gun from its shoulder holster. He heard the front door bang. Going through the anteroom, he saw the fat checker room girl holding her ears. He leaped over a man lying on the floor. He reached the door, yanked it open, and dived out on hands and knees. He heard running feet. Rising out of the small well, he climbed the stone steps, saw a dark figure fleeing west. He waited until he saw the figure speed beneath the street light. Then he raised his gun, fired. The bullet hit an ash can and scared away a couple of cats. It made Joe Palermo run faster. But Palermo spent a second at the next corner to spin. He used the corner of the building as a shield, and he fired. But he fired as Cardigan flopped behind the ash can, and the bullet whanged into galvanized iron. Cardigan got a mouthful of cinders. Spitting them out, he rose and raced on, skidded up to the corner, bent way down and looked around the corner, with his chin almost touching the sidewalk. Palermo fired, and bits of brick dribbled down to Cardigan's hat. Cardigan, kneeling, fired twice in succession. He saw Palermo stagger. He saw a truck driver jump from a truck and race out of sight. Jumping up, Cardigan broke into a run, saw the flash of Palermo's gun, heard a window 2 feet from his head fly to pieces. The crash of the glass commingled with the crash of his own gun. The echoes banged in the narrow, dark street. Going on, he saw Palermo walking around in a circle. It was curious, he thought, the way Palermo kept walking faster and faster, in the same circle, round and round. And then Palermo suddenly stopped walking and fell to his knees. He remained on his knees for a moment and then fell over backward. Doak sat on a straight-backed chair in his office, his feet far apart, but planted stolidly on the floor. "Yeah," nodded Cardigan. "Yeah, I shot Palermo, up because he shot Dorigo. It makes good reading material. So what the hell? I could have given Dorigo a pinch there, but no. He was so lousy mad at me that he was blind. He couldn't even get it through his nut that Palermo was drawing on him. I could have saved him these 3 weeks in the hospital he's going to spend. But I'm no dummy. I knew damn well that if I as so much as started toward my lapel, Dorigo would have blown my heart out. So I let him take that slug. I had to. And then I went after Palermo." "How the hell did you tie down on Palermo?" Cardigan shrugged. "First of all, you guys and a lot of other guys were bent on running the agency out of business. Then I didn't believe Murphy did it, and I told you why. The confetti in Molly Shane's dress gave me an idea. It meant a party. I walked my feet off finding where parties had been held on the night of the 22nd. I knew that Murphy didn't do the shooting because I found out that Murphy was down by the time Molly was shot."
"How'd you know?"
"His watch. His wristwatch. The bullet that killed Molly stopped the clock on the table behind her at 3 to 11. When Murphy was shot, he fell. He fell and smacked his watch on the floor. I took it to a jeweler who put new hands on it, and I found that his watch had stopped at 20 past 10, 37 minutes before Molly was shot. Pictures had been taken of Benjamino's party. I saw the pictures. Two chairs side by side were empty. I swiped the chairs. Off one, I got Molly's prints. Off the other, I got some prints I brought down here and looked up. They were Palermo's. I went out to find Palermo. Molly wrote poetry. When I met him in the room, I knew him right away from the pictures I'd seen here. But I would have known him from her bum poetry, too." Doak sighed, shook his head. Cardigan said, "You know, of course, what Palermo did. He told you in the hospital. He wanted Molly to help him dispose of Murphy's body. Murphy knew Palermo. He saw Palermo go into Hotel Gascon, and Murphy on the job wanted to find out what Palermo was doing there. He found out. Palermo was drunk and attacking Molly. And afterward, Palermo wanted her to swear she wouldn't tell who killed Murphy. And she wouldn't swear. Palermo shot her. Murphy was a sap. He walked into that apartment with his gun in his pocket. Palermo took it away from him, and Murphy was sap enough to try hand to hand. Murphy should have walked in with his gun drawn." Doak shoved his hands into his pockets, frowned, bit his lip. He said dully, "When Dorigo comes out of the hospital, he goes back to harness." "You're getting wise to him, huh?"
"I've been wise a long time,"
but I never acted. He kept staring hard at the floor, thrust out his hand. Cardigan reached out and shook it.